I'm Kathleen Dunn at the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I guess this hour has so much to talk about, we could just be on the air for hours. Colonel Ann Wright is with us. She is a former United States Army colonel and retired U.S. State Department official. She is one of three State Department officials to publicly resign in protest of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. She has participated in reconstruction efforts after U.S. military actions in Grenada and Somalia. She has served 13 years in active duty in the U.S. Army, 16 years in the Army Reserves, and in 1987 went to work for the Foreign Service at the U.S. State Department. She served as deputy of mission at the U.S. embassies in Afghanistan, helped open that following the 2001 U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. Sierra Leone, an embassy she closed and then reopened, Micronesia, Mongolia. She served at U.S. embassies in Uzbekistan, Pakistan, Kyrgyzstan, Grenada, and Nicaragua. And she's been a real activist. She's become a very prominent figure in the movement opposed to Middle East policy. She's been arrested several times, and we'll talk about that. Actually, I mean, she's just on the move all the time. She was arrested just last week at a five-day anti-drone protest at Creech Air Force Base near Las Vegas. So we'll be talking about that as well. We welcome your phone calls for Colonel Wright. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. I can't believe the schedule you keep, Colonel Wright. I mean, you were arrested last week, and now you're off to El Salvador on Sunday.
Indeed. Well, it's a schedule that reflects all of the challenges that we have in the world, and I'm very lucky that I am able to travel around and add my voice to those in the local communities who are challenging injustice wherever it may be.
Let's start with the drone program. I want to get into the Israeli elections in a moment, but I don't think most of us know about the drone program, and you were arrested there last week. I understand that there are a lot of pilots in the Air Force who don't want to be associated with that. They're having a hard time finding them because of the nature of the work.
Well, now we are training more pilots to be pilots of unmanned aerial vehicles, or these drones, than we are fixed-wing aircraft in the U.S. Air Force. Now, isn't that startling? That indeed the signature program for the Obama administration is assassin drones. That's what we call them, assassin drones. Drones that are hovering above Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, Somalia, that at the sometimes the individual direction of the President of the United States through his what's called the Terror Tuesday list, where the 16 intelligence agencies of the United States make up a list of who they feel should be killed by the United States in extrajudicial killing. By name, these people should die because of what they have done that's a security threat to the United States. And the president signs off on who he wants killed. These are the things that we are very concerned about. This is the intelligence community is not omnipotent. The intelligence community makes a lot of mistakes. And the number of innocent, unarmed civilians that are killed as a part of these drone attacks are legion. So we've traveled to lots of countries where these things are taking place. We've traveled to Afghanistan, to Pakistan, to Yemen, and talked with families of victims of assassin drones. And we think it's these drones, this weapon system, is actually a threat to the national security of the United States. It really doesn't help the United States, in my opinion.
Does it create more terrorists?
I believe it does. I mean, when you talk to people in these areas, they are angry, very angry. And, you know, there's one aspect of this that the U.S. government really hasn't given us the information about, and it's the fact that more U.S. soldiers have been killed in the last 3 years in Afghanistan by Afghans who we have trained, whether in the national police or the national military. More people in those two that we have trained have turned their weapons against U.S. servicemen and women. And then you ask why. Well, I would suggest that they need to do the analysis of where these people come from. And I would bet you that most of them come from the tribal regions along the Pakistan-Afghan border. and they know people who have been killed by these drones.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it is, it's backfiring on us on a variety of ways, and it's a program that I firmly believe needs to be done away with.
Mm-hmm. How did you get arrested?
Well,
for that time, you've been arrested before.
Well, all we do is end up crossing an arbitrary line. It's not like we're climbing over their fences, breaching the walls, trying to grab a drone. Actually, you know, Creech Air Base outside of Las Vegas is the only place where Americans can actually see these Predator and Reaper drones flying.
Oh, really?
It's very unique. At the other places where we do protest and where I and many, many others have been arrested, you actually don't see any drones. We know that the command that drone pilots are there in little cubicles, and they are operating drones that are physically 10,000 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
But it's at Creech Air Base that they practice, the very beginning pilots practice with a drone that's actually very close to where they are. So you can be standing out on the highway where we do our vigils, and you'll see a drone that's landing 500 feet from you. It's the only place where you can see them. And the topography of the area around Creech reminds me very much of Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And so here you are, and you see the drones, and then you start hearing them, which is what we're told in Afghanistan and Pakistan by families. We can hear the drones. We can hear them up there. And we never know when they're going to fire the missile. You never know what's going to happen. And the anguish that families have, that individuals have, knowing that there is something up there that's watching them. Because the reason the U.S. needs so many pilots is that we have drones up 24 hours a day. We are watching. And at any moment when the decision is made that that particular person or that particular car or that particular compound now has in it someone we think has done something to the United States, and then the pilot pushes the button, and a second and a half later, that missile, Hellfire missile, isn't that a name? Hellfire missile flies off that drone and blows up whatever it is.
And what about the whole process, just psychologically, of hitting that button thousands of miles away instead of being in a jet, a fighter jet, above the thing that you're going to bomb and doing it yourself so you can see what's happening? Is there something that makes some pilots not want to do that? Is there something that makes it easier to press that button if you're so far away?
Well, you're right that, you know, with a traditional jet aircraft where Air Force pilots or Navy pilots, Marine pilots are ordered to bomb something, they know where the target is, they center in on it, push the button, and then they're miles away by the time that bomb even hits. And they may not ever see the results of it. They may never be shown what happened. But for a drone pilot, they watch that missile go into that area. They see the body parts flying apart.
Mm.
They see the carnage of it. A tragic part of this is that we do what's called a double tap, that we may have a second round of missiles that are waiting for anyone who comes to aid the people who are in the building. And it may just be neighbors, people that are just passing by. And it is one of the things the U.S. government is doing, as well as the Israeli government doing on Palestinians, particularly in Gaza, that they will wait to see who comes and then fire another missile into it. And that's happened in places that inexplicably, but it's actually showing that our intelligence is not infallible. I mean, the U.S. drones have killed wedding parties and then killed others who have come to help those that were a part of a group of people, but it wasn't a group of militants. It was a group of people going to a wedding party.
Yeah. Let's talk about your deciding to make a statement by quitting your job when the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003. You've had a long career in the State Department, a long career in the Army. I mean, that was a pretty big thing for you to do, wasn't it?
Well, it certainly was. I mean, I knew that I would be giving up a career that at that point in the State Department as a diplomat. I was already a deputy ambassador in four different embassies.
Goodness.
So I was, you know, on the track to perhaps become an ambassador. So that weighed a little bit into this, but it really was that I was so deeply, concerned about what was going to be the effect of an invasion, and an invasion with what always comes with invasions, the killing of many, many, many people. And then the occupation of a country that had not done anything to the United States, had not been a part of 9/11, did not have al-Qaeda there. It was an oil-rich Arab Muslim country that had been under siege by the United States for 10 years at that time. After Gulf War I, the United States and the international community put two no-fly zones over the country. The U.S. Air Force conducted over 400,000 flight sorties, air sorties, taking out, destroying any infrastructure in Iraq we wanted to, plus a quarantine around the country, a quarantine that meant that anything that came into the country was checked by international inspectors, and a very brutal sanctions program that watched every bit of food, every bit of medicines that came in. And people were starving to death, were dying because of these sanctions. And our Secretary of State at the time, Madeleine Albright, was asked famously, do you consider the deaths of 500,000 Iraqi children during the sanctions program as something the United States should be proud of? And she said, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was necessary to put pressure on Saddam Hussein. So it was a country that was already on its knees, and then the Bush administration decided that we would invade and occupy it. It didn't make any sense to me, and particularly having just come out of Afghanistan, having been part of the group that reopened the U.S. Embassy there in December of 2001, and then I'd stayed there for 6 months, and then by the time I left, there were already these comments of the Bush administration about the threat. Well, when George Bush in January of 2002 in his State of the Union message started talking about Iran, Iraq, North Korea, the axis of evil. I mean, it was that just sent shivers up my spine. Like, what are you talking about? Here we're in Afghanistan now, and you're talking about all this other stuff. So as when I went on to my next assignment, which turned out to be my last one, which was in Mongolia, the war rhetoric just kept getting higher and higher and higher, and I could not for the life of me sort out why it was necessary to attack Iraq. And I finally, I think the one of the determining factors was when Colin Powell, my boss then as Secretary of State, gave the intelligence briefing to the UN Security Council. Mm-hmm. Hoping to get the vote of the United Nations to have an international military response to Saddam Hussein. When he gave that long, long, long presentation about here is the evidence we have of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And, you know, we'd been warned by Condoleezza Rice, you know, we have mushroom to be so cloud. Careful, the mushroom cloud. Mm-hmm. Well, when I saw this, and I was out in Mongolia watching TV like
you were watching
else,
it from Mongolia.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to see it because, I mean, this was going to be a life changer for everyone.
Right.
With this, you know, the U.S. going in. It was much different from 10 years before, when the U.S. as a part of an international coalition pushed Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait, which he had invaded. This one was actually going into Iraq, which has not attacked anybody.
Right.
At that point, for 10 years it hadn't. So I looked at the evidence my boss Colin Powell had presented and thought, looks a little flaky to me, and it just didn't make sense. So I, over a long period of time, just kept thinking and thinking about it. And finally, as the days were growing nearer to what you knew was going to be the invasion, I finally made the decision that I could not be a part of it. Mm-hmm. And so I resigned.
So you gave your letter of resignation to him. Did he say anything to you, Colin
Powell?
Well,
I cabled it from Mongolia all the way to Washington. And then about 4 days later, I'd already resigned, so I had no access back into the embassy. I was still living there because it took 10 days for them to get packing materials from China to come into Mongolia to pack me out to send me on my way. But the ambassador called one day and said, we'll send someone over to escort you back into the embassy because we have a message from Colin Powell. And, oh, my. So I went over there, and here was a message. Thank you for your service, both in the military and the State Department. Good luck.
Oh, my goodness.
But I found out later, friends of mine in the State Department told me later, they said, oh, you would not believe the gyrations the State Department went through on what to tell you. The first set of paragraphs that came out were essentially, well, you don't seem to understand anything. You're not reading all the rationale of what we're doing. It was kind of a brutal thing back to somebody that's just resigned, and that went up to Colin Powell, and he said, no, that's not what I want to tell her, and kind of, you know, soften this, da-da-da-da. So a second copy went up to him, and he reportedly said, no, that is not what I want. Just tell her, thank you very much, and good luck. Hmm. And so that's what came back.
Interesting. He probably should have listened to you a little more carefully at that point, because he certainly had great consternation later about what he said before the UN, right?
Well, actually, he hasn't backed off too much. He has.
I thought he had in the book that he wrote.
Not too much. He's still, you know, it would have been his resignation that could have possibly changed the course of the war.
Mm-hmm.
But he has not backed off too much. His chief of staff at the State Department, retired Army Colonel Larry Wilkerson, has definitely been one who has now been very public about the fact that they picked the very best that the CIA offered up as the evidence. But both he and Colin Powell, Larry Wilkerson says, knew that this was not definitive evidence that there were weapons of mass destruction.
Hmm.
And Colin Powell's wife, Alma Powell, is the one who said that that briefing was one of the darkest days in the history of their family.
Was it?
Yeah.
Interesting. We welcome phone calls. We have other areas to discuss with our guest, who has really lived quite a life, and she's nowhere near done. Colonel Ann Wright is with us, former U.S. Army Colonel, retired U.S. State Department official who's worked for embassies all over the world, one of three State Department officials to publicly resign in protest of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. She is at Marquette, and she is going to be there for, how long are you there for?
I've been here 2 days. I'll be here. Actually, this is my third, and the Center for Peacemaking is my sponsor, and they've organized a tremendous series of events for me to speak in and people to meet, and I've really been pleased.
Great. We welcome phone call. Oh, my goodness, you have a full bank of phone lines here. I'm sorry, I didn't look at the audience. We were just engrossed in what we were saying. We'll start taking your phone calls in just one moment. We also want to talk about the big news out of Israel yesterday, because I'm sure her guest, she mentioned Palestine, will have some worthwhile comments about the election of Netanyahu and what it means with his public comments late in the game that there would be no two-state solution, what that does for Israel's future, what it does for our future with Israel, the Palestinians' future, et cetera. We'll be sure and get her take on that and more issues. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and that's that. We'll be with you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Colonel Ann Wright is with us now, and we go to your phone calls on a variety of topics. We start with Ray in Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Hi, Kathleen, and good afternoon, Colonel Ann Wright. I just found a new hero, I guess. I really am moved by what you have said, and that you are willing to give up so much because, you know, your heart couldn't follow the path of killing and all that. But I want to get into a little bit of Colonel Powell, maybe. When he gave that speech, everyone should remember they covered the mural, the anti-war mural behind him, the Guernica mural, which was about, I guess, Spain's, their civil war. And it's a very moving mural, and when we are afraid of artwork while telling our lies, that should tell the whole world something. Everybody should YouTube that and look at that again and think hard about what he said and why they had to cover that mural while he was speaking. But I want to talk about some of the drone bombings. One of them, for instance, I believe it was in Afghanistan. We killed a grandmother who was out in a field planting, and her grandchildren were watching as she was blown apart by a drone missile. Now, these are the photographs we should see in this country. And if we saw those photographs, we would have a whole different feeling about this drone thing. And we should worry when foreign countries develop their drones to such a level that they can fly them over Texas or Florida or the West Coast or the East Coast. How will we feel then? Will we still be saying this is a fair fight?
Well, thank you, Ray. It's a good question. And first, on your earlier comment, I had totally forgotten about that Guernica mural being covered. That's something yes, we should always remember that if our government's not willing to face what they're doing directly by the images of what war really is, then that really says a lot. And the images of an Afghan grandmother being blown apart by a drone missile and the grandkids being in the garden, I mean, that's one of endless stories that we have heard in Afghanistan and in Pakistan and in Yemen. The numbers of innocent civilians that have been killed by these drones, and I mean, it's really a mystery to me because our military says, well, we are very, very careful, that we have cameras that are so precise that we can see people's faces, we can see them, and then how in the world can they be killing people that they can determine? Somebody working in the garden, and all of a sudden that person's blown up, or they can see that it's a wedding party that's out there and not a militant group, or they can see those young boys that were on the hillside that were out picking wood, and all of a sudden they are blown up. So while our government says it's very, very precise and it saves lives, actually, it's actually not saving lives at all. And the blowback that could be, and I'll just mention a book that has been written by Richard Clark, who is a former national security advisor, is the fellow in the Bush administration that said his hair was on fire because of all of these indications that there was going to be some sort of attack on the United States, and he couldn't get the attention of Condoleezza Rice and Dick Cheney and President Bush about the indications that they were getting. Well, Richard Clark has written a book called The Sting of the Drone, and it's exactly what you're talking about, that there were people who their families had been harmed by drones, and that they decided to get back at the United States, and they actually attacked drone operators in their homes in Las Vegas. They attacked the drone facility on Creech Base. And this is written by a guy, I mean, I was kind of amazed that he wrote it, considering his security classification, his prestige of where he's come from, and the fact that, I mean, it is kind of a book of what potentially, I hate to say probably, I hope not probably, but potentially could happen very, very easily. I mean, in other parts of the world, we see that there's blowback from things that happen. We in the United States have really been we have not seen that happen here, which is remarkable, in my opinion. We've seen 9/11 happen, but the ease at which other things could happen in our country makes me glad that nothing's happened, but I would not be shocked if something like what is in his book comes to pass.
Thanks very much for your call, Ray. And let's go next to Matt in Minnesota. Hi, Matt.
Hi, guys. And I was just wondering what your thoughts were on ISIS and, you know, how there's this theory that they kind of want to draw the West into a war, kind of to bring on Armageddon and try to bring about the end of the world or judgment or whatever. And then also you thought about Ukraine, you know, and like what's the United States' response? There's kind of a movement towards providing legal aid to the Ukrainian army to help defeat these, you know, separatists or these Russian-backed militants. You know, we know what they are. You know, we know it's Russia that's in there doing it. I just was wondering what your response was to those two different crises. So thank you.
Thanks.
And we have, what, 3 hours?
Well, oh, we got 30 minutes.
Okay. Yeah. Well, there we can handle all this. Well, no, very important questions on ISIS. I mean, a group that has an outlook, theory that essentially they will rule a part of the world or an expanding part of the world in a most brutal fashion, according to their interpretation of Islam, which is rejected by most everybody that is a Muslim. They are brutal. They are horrible. They've kidnapped people. They've killed tons of them. And they grew out, in my opinion, of the U.S. decision to invade and occupy Iraq. I mean, the chaos that came out of that, the Maliki government that then took revenge almost on Sunnis in the West in particular, and then this small group of people known as ISIS all of a sudden found that they could overrun military bases in Western Iraq and take the military equipment that had been given by the United States to the new military of Iraq, and suddenly it was equipped beyond their wildest dreams. It had the modern elements of war, and then they started a campaign, a recruiting campaign that is one of the most sophisticated recruiting campaigns using social media, and calling on the youth of the Muslim world to come and fight for injustices being done to Muslims. I mean, and it's a strange way that they're doing it, but mm-hmm. there are so many disaffected youth around the world that they are attracting these kids to come in there. And then, as we've seen by other groups that become almost messianic in their mission, that they really suck them in and get them to do things that in their wildest dreams a year ago they really probably wouldn't be doing. But I would say it's a real lesson to us that military operations and the decision to use military force to resolve political issues has unintended consequences beyond our wildest nightmares.
And how do we counter them now?
Well, yeah, that's right. How do you counter them now? Well, one of the things is that for the United States to think it has to be the one to counter it, that it has to be the one. That's one thing I think we should be counseling our government, that we don't have to be the world's policeman, and that there are other countries in the region that are more directly affected. And they've all been the recipients of U.S. military aid, U.S. military training. And to me, that it's a regional problem. It is a problem that among the Muslim communities they need to resolve. And I would certainly hope that they can do it with a minimum amount of violence and hopefully in a nonviolent way. But I think as you see what ISIS is, it's going to be a real challenge on them. There are the combination of the Peshmerga of the Kurds, elements of the Iraqi military, and interestingly enough, the Iranian military, mm-hmm. who has been, the Shia government of Iraq, which came into power as the first election under the Bush administration. The Shia government has been allied with Iran from the very beginning, and the Iranian military has sent military trainers, and I don't know the full extent of what they have there, but apparently it was the Iranian contingent that the Iraqis called on to help with this battle that's going on right now for the second largest city in Iraq, for Mosul. So it's not like the U.S. has to do everything. And I think one of the things that I would encourage citizens to do is counsel our government that for us to militarily keep getting involved in these things is not going to resolve the issues. And on this, particularly this regional thing, I think it should be the people of the region that are doing this and not U.S. soldiers.
Matt mentioned Ukraine. Would you like to comment on Ukraine?
Mm-hmm. Well, the Ukrainian situation, which is another thing of unintended consequences, where the U.S., if you think back 2 years ago, the United States had a program to support the opposition of the elected government of the Ukraine, a government that was more allied with the Russian government than with the West. But the president was elected by the people of the Ukraine. And the United States started a multi-million-dollar, I think it was over $100 million campaign to unseat the president, essentially calling for a coup against an elected president. And we even had our Secretary of State for our Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, Victoria Nuland, was famously quoted by the Russians as they overheard her telephone conversation in the Ukraine as she was handing out cookies to the opposition forces that had set up all sorts of blockades in downtown Kiev. You know, that our guy, our boy, so-and-so, we've got him lined up, ready to go. Well, so the opposition took over the government. The elected president had to flee in his helicopter in the middle of the night. And then what did Russia do? Well, you know, most Americans don't quite realize that the southern military end of the Russian military establishment was actually located still in the Ukraine. It was in the Crimean Peninsula. That's where the Russians had a lot of their military equipment, and it was a naval port. That was one of their exit ways out through the Black Sea and then into the Bosphorus and then out to the Mediterranean Sea. So it's a very, very important, vital military installation. And then all of a sudden they saw that, in their opinion, it was under threat. So the drastic action of essentially the annexation of Crimea so that Russia could protect that area. Well, I mean, talk about unintended consequences. I think, unless it was an intention of the Obama administration, that's what they wanted the Russians to have to do so that there could be more tensions in the area. Now, I hope that's not it. I actually think, and having been involved in U.S. diplomacy for a long period of time, I've seen things that have happened that it was like, God, didn't anybody think about that? that actions were taken that there was nobody said, well, yeah, the probable reaction of the Russian government is that they are going to protect that military installation no matter what, and it's going to precipitate a real crisis. Well, what's now happened, that the Ukraine has just been, the southeastern part of it has just been blown apart. Over 20,000 people that have been killed there. I mean, you look at the level of the shelling, the artillery back and forth, and I mean, it's a horrific situation.
Well, what about what you just said? Didn't anybody think about that? We wonder that whenever there are certain actions that are taken, particularly the invasion of Iraq. Didn't anybody think about what the consequences would be? Didn't anybody think about what our policy is in Afghanistan? We hear there are a lot of people serving who don't understand what the language is of the places in which they're serving. I mean, it's an interesting thing that you just said. Are there fine minds in the State Department, in the Army, who indeed are... we're paying them, we're hoping that they're going to say, well, let's think about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are very fine minds, and I bet you for Iraq, we know that there was an Iraq study group that for a year put together the probable consequences of the U.S. going into Iraq, and they were shunned. They were, their consequences were never allowed to be debated in the higher reaches of the government. All we know, what we know is that President Bush, Vice President Cheney, Colin Powell, Donald Rumsfeld all said this is going to be a cakewalk. It'll be a cakewalk. And yet there were people in our military and the State Department, no, it's not going to be a cakewalk. I mean, there are forces in there, even though the U.S. has destroyed a heck of a lot of the Iraqi military, there are forces in there that are not going to let the U.S. come just roaring right on in. And part of those forces that fought against the U.S. coming in are the ones, I mean, if you think of the generals of the Iraqi military, that was a big military. And it was a pretty well-trained, as the U.S. found out when it was not a cakewalk getting in there. And then when we had Paul Bremer, the viceroy for the United States to put in its own king, its own viceroy, to run the country, and his first decision was to kick out the debathification, take out the Ba'ath Party. Well, most of the people in the Ba'ath Party were in there because if you weren't in it, Saddam Hussein was going to get mad at you, so you joined up. Not necessarily that you agreed with it, but it was a way to stay alive. The military was not necessarily all loyal to Saddam Hussein. And in fact, most of our U.S. military was saying to Paul Bremer, keep the military in. At least we can watch it. We can control it. We can maybe retrain it. But no, the decision made by our politicians, was we are going to kick all those guys out. Well, to the question of ISIS, guess who ISIS has hired? I mean, ISIS has a lot of money. They get a lot of money from all of the oil that they are sending out. That they control the refineries of northern Iraq and some in Syria. They're making tons of money. It's one of the most well-funded insurgent groups ever in the history of the world. And so they bought off these old generals from Iraq who have been, they have had nothing to do for years. They've been iced out of everything, and so they have been hired to come and be the military strategists, the logisticians of this ISIS force, which actually was not particularly well trained or well equipped in the very beginning, but they've bought off these guys. So these consequences that should be looked at, should be in the parlance of the government, they should be war gamed. You should be thinking about all of the possible options, consequences of all of this, and we're not.
We're going to continue our conversation, which is wide-ranging because of the nature of all that she has done, with Colonel Anne Wright. Yesterday, a significant election in Israel. We'll talk about the re-election of Benjamin Netanyahu and how big a thing this was. He rejected a Palestinian state late in the election. He went even farther to the right. What are the consequences of that for that region, for our relationship with Israel, and for Israel's relationship with other countries in the world? We'll ask Colonel Wright about that and take more of your phone calls, too. Thank you, Matt, for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The re-election of Benjamin Netanyahu, who went farther right before the election, saying there would not be a two-state solution. A lot of media commentators are saying this is a very big thing, and there will be huge consequences both for Israel and Israel's relationship with neighboring countries and our relationship with Israel. Was it?
Well, I totally agree. I think it was a statement that Netanyahu made to try to get more people to come out to the polls to vote for him. And that very serious thing that he said to attract the attention of those who are more on the right wing of the Israeli electorate really has sent shockwaves, I think, through the international community. Mm-hmm. That here you have a fellow who... maybe he believed that the whole time, but he hadn't said it publicly. But for him, on the eve of the election, to use it as a tactic to get more people so he can be reelected, and then the consequences, here we go, unintended consequences. One would think that he probably could imagine the level of disbelief, anger, of the international community that has been diligently working with the Israelis and Palestinians on the issue of peace and some solution to the problem, whether it's the course has been on a two-state solution. So for the fellow that was trying to get elected to say, I'm going to throw out essentially decades of work for peace in this region, it has just stunned everyone. And how he's going to get out of this hole, I don't know, because it will create extraordinary anger in the region. The Palestinians, who have been hanging in there on these negotiations, even though, as most Palestinians say, every time there's a peace negotiation, we lose ground. Because that's when the Israeli government authorizes more illegal settlements to go in under the cover of, well, wait a minute, we're still talking about peace, but, you know, another 1,000 residences that are now scheduled It always happens during a peace process. Mm-hmm. The apartheid walls that are there, how would a one-state solution look? I mean, with this sort of rhetoric of we'll never let the Palestinians have their own state, and if you look at the plight of Palestinians or Arabs who are Israeli citizens, and if you look at the ghettos in Israel where Arabs live with their citizens, they pay taxes, and yet the benefits they get out of that are not like Israeli Jewish citizens. So I think it is a really big deal, and I'm sure the Obama administration, as well as the other nations that have been a part of the peace processes, are just flummoxed. They are stunned.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's go to more phone calls. Our next caller is Claire from Madison. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you very much. This is a great topic. I also would like to echo a previous caller that I admire the Colonel for her standing for her convictions. I think that's just a tremendous sacrifice on her part after all those years she put in on the other side, so to speak. But my question is, Kathleen and guest, as I understand it, the United States has by far like 10 times the next highest country's budget for military. And right now in Congress, the military budget is being debated, and generals and Pentagon officials are begging for more money, even more money, and I'd like to get the Colonel's feedback on that, what she thinks, what her comments are on that whole issue.
Well, I think the U.S. military is overfunded by many multiples of times. We have the largest, strongest military in the world by generations, and the continual quest for more and more money for our military and feeds nothing more than the military-industrial commercial complex. I mean, we have to have enemies so that we will have the ability to pour more money into these industries that make the war materials. So I think as citizens, we should be really strong in urging our congressmen and women to say no more for the military. We need to be downsizing. We definitely need to. And actually, the Congress has mandated that the number of military personnel has to decrease because the budget is so out of alignment with the rest of the needs that we have in our country. So we need to say fewer people in our military, and the new generations of equipment that is being talked about. Yeah, certainly there needs to be a renovation of a certain amount. I mean, like the B-52s are 50 years old. Of course, I hope the B-52s are never used again. But the United States certainly goes overboard in its military budgets.
Thanks very much, Claire, for your call. We go next to Maryland in Madison. Hi, Maryland.
Hi. If I could ask your guest to just go back for a minute to 2008, I was curious, were you surprised that Colin Powell came out in support of Obama when he first ran?
Well, it's a very good point, yes. It was interesting. Here, Secretary of State Colin Powell, who had been almost at one stage being talked about running for president as a Republican. In fact, he would have been running a nominee against George Bush. And he did come out for President Obama. I was surprised on one level, but not on another.
Hmm. Did you? I find it interesting that you had this very lengthy career in the military and in the State Department, and I'm wondering if you ever felt like giving it up before 2003. What was it about 2003? There must have been other things that made you upset, weren't there?
Well, for sure. I mean, I worked under the administrations of 8 different presidents.
Oh, goodness.
Starting with Lyndon Johnson, you know, during the Vietnam War.
Uh-huh. Oh, my.
And then ending with George Bush. So there were plenty of policies that I personally didn't really agree with. But as most government employees, you know, we don't really have history of having resignation from government on principle as one of the hallmarks of...
No, you don't.
No, and right. we don't teach that in schools, that there are ways that you can show your displeasure, and if you really are upset about something, that resignation is a way that you can... That's the ultimate expression of it. That's just not really a part of American culture, and definitely not in the government, which is a little bit... It's different from, like, in the British government. The Brits have people that resign on principle much more frequently than we do. In fact, 5 times more people resigned over the Iraq War in the British government than did in the U.S., which only meant they had 15, but 15 versus 3 in a much smaller government. Yes, there were plenty of programs and policies of various administrations that I didn't agree with, but I found other areas than those policies that I worked in that I felt like these are good things. I'm not harming anybody. But when you really look at it, the main policies really did affect everything. And so looking back on it, there were plenty of places that maybe I should have resigned over this issue or that issue. And there were some people in our government that did resign on certain things. And I remember thinking about them. Yeah, boy, that they really feel strongly about that one. But I'm working in this field, and I think I'm doing okay.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, and you know, I was toward the end of my career. One would say I was in my 50s when I resigned, and yet we have other people who took really great steps of courage and resistance, really, who are young. I mean, we had military folks who refused to go to Iraq, saying no. This is wrong. This is wrong, and I'm not going to go. Or we had them who had been to Iraq once, and when they were ordered back, they said, I've seen what we're doing there, and no, I'm not going to do it. Or we had people who were whistleblowers on what the U.S. government was doing in prisons, in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. Soldiers who let us know what was going on in Abu Ghraib, or the names of the people who were in Guantanamo. And they ended up in prison, one of them in prison mm-hmm. and the other one under federal protection because he was being threatened by fellow members of his own military unit. So my resignation was one level, but there were other people who ended up in jail. I mean, if you look at the whistleblowers right now in the National Security, NSA, and on communications, you look at what's happened to them. We have Chelsea Manning, who's in prison for 30 years. We have Julian Assange, in exile in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. We have Ed Snowden, who's in Russia. And all they're doing is letting us know what our government's doing and the illegal things our government has been doing.
We have about a minute left. Let's go to Steve in Danbury. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks, Kathleen. Thank God, Ms. Wright, for you. I appreciate your bravery. You saw what was going to happen in Iraq, and sure enough, we're seeing the blowback from that misguided adventure now. I'm just wondering, in light of the Republican letter to the Iranian hardliners, where do you think it's going to go with Iran at this point?
Well, the Iranian leader, I think it was the president of the country, Rouhani, sent back a letter that I think was a tutorial to the congressman that signed that letter about all the things that you guys may send us this thing, but, you know, it's we know more about international relations than you do. And I don't think the Iranians are being thrown off track on this thing. They certainly recognize the political situation in the United States. They understand that there are some... We talk about the hotheads in Tehran. Well, the hotheads that we have in Washington are something that governments around the world actually, I think, know our government and the politicians in it better than we do. And I think the Iranian government has probably had a few chuckles over how stupid, idiotic this letter was, and that they will not be... It's in their interest. I've been to Iran before, and you know the Iranian people. They want peace. They don't want to have military operations or anything like that against the United States. They just want peace. And I think the ruling government is ready to work a deal with the West on this issue of nuclear energy and centrifuges. And I certainly hope they won't be deterred by a group of U.S. congressmen and women who have done what I think is a really stupid thing.
Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my
really
pleasure.
Interesting. Colonel Ann Wright, former U.S. Army colonel, retired U.S. State Department official, one of three State Department officials to publicly resign in protest of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. She is at Marquette now. She is at the Center for Peacemaking and has a pretty busy week ahead of her. She's going to El Salvador on Sunday. And she got arrested last week. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Great conversations ahead.